everyone, I'm Brian Conley of Hunters HD Gold, and you're listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. This podcast takes a deep dive into what it takes to be a match director, manufacturer, sponsored shooter, or just an everyday shooter trying to win his or her first major. So sit back and enjoy this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Welcome back to another episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Today, we've been trying to get together for a while. We've had a lot of things come up. I had some things happen in my life, then he had some things happening in his life. But today, I've sat down with Ben Berry. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great, man. It's good to talk to you.
Finally. You know, I'll tell you a quick story, because I got into the shooting sports, you know, in late 17 and in early 18. And the first time I heard about your name, you were associated with the Bens.
Oh, boy.
So I told Steger the same thing. I think we talked about it at the same time. You know, that's how I was introduced to, you know, the Bens. And didn't even know who anybody was. There was a lot of stuff going on. And I told Sherry, I said, there's a lot of drama going on here. I don't know what this is all about. There's a lot of stuff going on. And so Sherry, my wife, was intrigued. Thought it was kind of funny as well. So been through a lot. But we won't dive into that today. I just want to let you know, I thought it was the funniest story. That's how I heard about you, was through that story a long time ago. But when did you even first start, you know, handling a gun? Was this something you did with your family growing up and hunting? Or what did that look like?
No, it was actually... In college, I had some friends who were into IDPA, and okay. I'd never shot a gun before. The first time I was ever in the presence of a gun being fired was at an IDPA match.
So you went to go just watch?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They said, hey, just come, you know, come check this out. And I'd never shot before. And so I thought, well, I mean, they don't charge anything for admission to spectate. So yeah, I just showed up and watched, and pretty quickly I was like, yeah, I want to, whatever this is, I want a piece of it.
So, but you never owned, have you owned a gun before then?
Nope, never even handled one.
So it's just one of those things that, you know, what were you going to college for?
Computer science.
So you're just around a bunch of guys that may have been the same kind of degree going on, and somebody had shot, and you said, let's go hang out and do this one day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, so what was your first experience when you got there and seeing everything going on?
Just seeing sort of the process of how everything was structured. And, you know, obviously there was the restrictions of the stage, but then also sort of the freedom, and you could see how much better somebody could get. And don't get me wrong, I grew up on video games and you know, shooter games. And so kind of seeing the connection to, you know, something like that was very clear. But seeing like, hey, this is something that's actually physical. It's a real skill you can learn. And I had always, you know, I'd never grown up around guns, but I had it in my mind that I'd probably end up getting my concealed carry permit at some point and something like that. I was always sort of pro-gun, very libertarian.
Okay.
Obviously still am. And so when I saw that there was more to shooting than just going to the square range and punching holes in paper, but there was this whole structure, this rule set and this organization around it, I thought, okay. And got started from there.
Now, how many years ago was that?
That would have been 2010, 2011. So about 10 years. I shot IDPA for a couple of years. Had some friends that shot USPSA as well. They got me shooting both. And then at a certain point, once I got serious about practicing, the question became, do I go to the range and practice on the weekends, or do I go shoot an IDPA match? And it got to the point where practice still wins most of the time. But I'll shoot the odd IDPA match now and then. I still have all the gear. I still consider those people friends.
Did your college buddies help you out buying equipment, or how'd you research that?
No. So I ended up, the guy that was the match director there, he also taught classes. And, so I just started taking some classes from him. He kind of pointed me, he said, hey, you know, Glock 17, it's a good gun. Not everybody likes it, but you can't go wrong. And so that was the first gun I ever bought, and, still have it today and still shoot it. And, I shoot other things now, but, you know, for example, when I was getting into carry optics last year and I just wanted something simple, slap a dot on it just to try it out, I thought, let me just get a Glock 17 MOS.
Right.
Put the dot on there. And that was kind of my first foray, just because it was, you know, it's turnkey. It's still the go-to first time gun, I think. Right. There are lots of great options similar, but it's still a good one.
So what was the conversation like when your family, when you told him you found this, we'll call it a hobby at the time, I'm sure, because you didn't know what you were going to be getting into. What was your parents' thoughts, not growing up around guns? Did they have any thoughts about this one way or the other? And as a college kid?
They were like, oh, that's interesting. Cause you know, they had done, you know, like, they were into like other, you know, theater and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Growing up. And so, you know, I'd helped out around the theater. Like I did more like the construction, you know, building sets and that kind of stuff, learning mm-hmm. to use all the tools and tool shops. That was fun for me. And so when, you know, I kind of went off and this was becoming more of a thing, they thought it was cool. I mean, okay. you know, we always grew up again. It was very, you know, nobody was afraid of guns. It just wasn't something anybody in the family had experience with. Right. And so, you know, when I got into it, then they were asking me questions about, oh, how does it work? You know, everybody was curious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then 4 or 5 years pass and everybody, you know, sees where you moved to and they assume, you know, oh, you grew up with guns. It's like, nope, I never shot a gun until I was 20 years old.
That's awesome.
You know,
that's awesome. Because some theaters, families and people that grew up in that business lean more towards the, you know, right. arts council and stuff like that, which is more of a give back political look mm-hmm. of view instead of, you know, always, you know, the capitalism that we know today. So that's why I asked that question, if it was any kind of, you know, different beliefs there or anything. So that's cool to know. Did, you know, so you did that for like how long in IDPA? You said 2 or 3 years before you went to USPSA?
Yeah. I shot the 2012 IDPA Nationals, which happened to be here in North Carolina, up in North Carolina where I lived. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, that was a good time. And then I sort of started branching out in 2013, joined early 2013, worked the 2013, the state match that year. I worked it. I didn't even shoot it, but I did shoot it with staff, but you know, it never even occurred to me. I just thought, well, I want to learn as much as I can. So I'll sign up to work it. And get started that way.
So when you went from IDPA to USPSA, there's, you know, I'm not sure how it was back then because I'm not aware of it, but now I know there's a big difference mm-hmm. now. Was the difference still the same? Being a lot faster and a lot more, you know, less restrictions?
Definitely. I mean, you know, you had to have a lot more magazines. At the time, you know, well, production still is 10 rounds, but at the time, you know, SSP was 10 rounds. So I was still used to shooting kind of 10 rounds and reloading, but mm-hmm. obviously being able to reload, you know, before the gun's empty was nice. But yeah, it was eye opening coming to, you know, another world where there was not kind of this in IDPA. If you push things too far, you start racking up procedurals, especially in the days before IDPA having fault lines for cover,
right.
Cover was very subjective. And to some degree, your demeanor kind of determined the cover procedurals that you got. And mm-hmm. so if you were sort of more hesitant in your demeanor, you tended to pick them up less. And so it was definitely more subjective. Whereas, yeah, coming to IDPA or coming to USPSA and saying either my foot's over the line or it isn't, I can go as fast as I want. Mm-hmm. You know, as a 20-something kid, I was like, yeah, this is it.
As a 20-something-year-old kid, when you first heard the initials USPSA, what did it mean to you when you first heard it? Did you think it was bigger than what it was based on United States Practical Shooting Association, or did you just think it was? Did you have a thought process like this is the big leagues kind of thing compared to IDPA?
It's funny. I remember thinking that, but with IDPA, because IDPA is international.
Yes, right.
Right? And so right. I figured, you know, IDPA was probably the bigger thing. But, you know, yeah, once you start to actually see kind of the level of competition, you know, even back then you were starting to be able to go on YouTube and pull up, you know, some world shoot footage and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think pretty quickly, I started reading and I was like, okay, we're the regional affiliate of this larger international body. So we're kind of the local chapter. So, you know, obviously we were a representative of that, but also our own organization. Mm-hmm. So
when you got with IDPA, did you ever become a safety officer with IDPA? I mean, yeah, IDPA, I got it right. Yeah. Safety mm-hmm. officer. Did you ever do anything with that? Were there?
I didn't. And honestly, if there had been a class, I probably would have taken it. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw a USPSA RO class open up in 2013, I took it.
Right. Okay.
Just because it was one of those where it was one of these chances to sort of learn more and have an opportunity to become, you know, more, just have a better understanding of everything.
Right.
And, you know, not have to learn it the hard way.
Right. That's true. Did you go for your CRO as well with USPSA?
I did. Yeah. Which was, it was a really fun experience. So yeah, I got my RO and then, ended up going in 2014. I had the opportunity to go out and work the Nationals in Utah, which was just, I mean, still to this day, one of the key experiences, sort of turning points for me.
Right.
But then coming back from that, I was able to, get the CRO. And then since then I would work as a CRO at the local club and we would host the section match.
What do you mean by turning point? Is that when you decided it was going to be a sport? at that time, or did you go into it thinking it was a sport out of IDPA? When did that switch for you of being, okay, this is something I'm doing, I like this, mm-hmm. but now I'm seeing there's people to beat,
right?
And there's major opportunities here to improve. When did that flip for you?
Yeah, it was the fall of 2014. So I want to say it was either August or September was nationals. And then Steve Anderson actually came and was teaching a class at Rowan County, which is where the NC section has been, where Area 6 mm-hmm. has been. He'd been brought in to teach a class, and I got into that class.
Oh, wow.
And between the two, and, you know, the thing with that class was, you know, he taught some techniques, but it was really the mindset of, hey, if you dry fire, if you work really hard in your garage, no ammo needed, you can really go far. You know, that was an idea that I hadn't really been exposed to before. I thought that if I want to get better at shooting matches, I just got to shoot as many matches as I can. So mm-hmm. I would shoot, you know, 3-4 matches a month. And then to sort of go into this class mindset and say, you can get really good, but the way is to actually have this sort of deliberate, what I would now call deliberate practice. You know, mm-hmm. you have that regimented schedule. And then also the nationals, you know, having the context of seeing, I mean, we'd always had a few GMs floating around in North Carolina. You know, sometimes Todd Jarrett would come down and shoot, that right. kind of thing. So I'd seen a few really good shooters, but seeing a nationals where it was just wall to wall, just all kinds of talent,
right?
And saying, I could do this, you know, if I really, and at the time, you know, I was still like playing video games and dabbling. And mm-hmm. At that point, I basically just stopped playing video games,
right?
And just started dry firing.
So what was your rating, your level of, what level shooter were you when you took the Steve Anderson class?
A B class. Yeah.
Okay, so when you went to your first nationals, what were you? What was your?
So it was B class.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
So being a B class shooter going to nationals and then being surrounded by all the masters and grandmasters, everything else, I guess that was pretty overwhelming. Real quick, seeing like, oh, I thought I was on something going right, but this is a different level altogether.
I mean, it was really inspiring.
Okay,
You know, because I mean, when you go to nationals, unless you kind of follow around the super squad or that kind of thing, you don't mm-hmm. actually kind of get to see that much of a kind of snapshot of everybody.
Right.
You see the people on your squad, the people before and after you see a very sort of narrow view of the whole stage or mm-hmm. of the whole match. Whereas what I found really interesting about working nationals is every single squad came through and I got to see such a wide cross section of folks.
Right.
You know, I would see the guys who were really keyed up and really, you know, really tense about everything, and then they'd go and shoot and they'd mm-hmm. you know, have some jam, and it would really throw them off. And then you'd see the super squads come through, and everybody, you know, the super squads were helpful, they knew the rules, everybody was helping to pace and reset, everybody mm-hmm. kind of knew the drill. And just seeing that and being like, I want to be like those guys, the ones who know what's going on, mm-hmm. they're not, you know, fussing over the little details, they're processing things through and just doing their best. And, you know, not trying to be some of these guys, you know, arguing over every penalty and that right. kind of stuff. It was very inspiring to sort of see that cross section. And it was sort of like a choose your own adventure. It's like, which kind of person do you want to be?
Right.
And, to sort of have that exposure and then, you know, sort of have the world of deliberate practice opened up to me shortly thereafter.
Did you go by yourself? Or did you go with some people from North Carolina?
No. So I, when I worked as staff, and so I just sent in the staff application
right.
and, you know, there was, I was totally going on my own. It was wow. just it was one of these where, you know, as a young 20 something kid to basically get a free trip out to Utah, you know, right. they put me up in a hotel, they paid for the flight. I split the rental car with another guy mm-hmm. and, you know, it was basically a free vacation to Utah. I was like, yeah, why would I not do this?
Right.
And, met a lot of interesting folks and learned a lot.
Very cool. Let's take a quick break and then we'll get into some more of what it was like when you started doing your training classes and what that looked like getting into getting into the depths of like, okay, I'm looking behind the curtain a little bit and see what that looked like for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second. Let's do some more of our sponsors. This week's podcast is brought to you by Kona Gold. Kona Gold is a premier lifestyle brand for those who work hard and play harder. There are many hemp companies out there that get lost in the crowd, but Kona Gold sets the gold standard with its premier line of products. When traveling all around with a Magical Mystery Tour to different matches, I travel around with lots of different flavors, including pink grapefruit, candy apple, and vanilla cherry. Make sure to stop by and get some for yourself. They are all zero calories, zero sugar, use organic hemp, and are THC and CBD free. Competitive shooters love them because there's no shakes, no headaches, and no crash. When you order from ConnieGoldHemp.com, make sure to use discount code HUNTERSHD for another 20% off. So you had, you know, just a huge eye-opening experience at Nationals. I can relate because I had the same experience when I went to my first, you know, 9 days or 9 days of Nationals and back to back to back being gone for 11 days on the road and coming out with Hunters HD Gold, you know, really for the first time USPSA and seeing all these people that I heard people talk about and then actually seeing them walk by the booth. They didn't know me from Adam at the time going, oh, that's so-and-so. Oh, wow. You know, really huge experience for me as well. So when you got back, that was your turning point and then training started. So to go from B level after Steve Anderson's class, how long did it take you to get to the, you know, to master or grandmaster? Did you take more training classes with other people? Was he pretty much your only mentor at the time?
No, I mean, over around that time, I ended up, there were a few classes, Ben Steger had come through. And so I ended up taking some classes with him.
Okay.
Like one a year for two or three years back to back. Just there was a guy who'd bring him into a local range. And so, you know, early in the year, we'd do some training there. And then, you know, yeah, following, you know, some of the, like his dry fire book, Steve Anderson's dry fire book, Steger's dry fire book.
Okay.
And, yeah, I just sort of started chipping away at it. So I made A class the next year, M class the year after that, and then GM the year after that.
Oh, so a 3-year process then.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, April Fool's Day, 2017.
Right.
Made production GM.
2017. Wow. That's about the time I got started. So when you first met Ben, that was at a training class. So
yeah.
So how was it meeting somebody of his intensity? Because Steve Anderson, I've seen his stuff. He's a very motivational, you know, type person who builds up and builds up from the inside, you know, which is pretty cool about Steve. But Ben Steger, from what I've heard, is if somebody is at their class and they're engaged, he's on them because he wants to see them improve. And if somebody is there at his class, just kind of observing, but taking the class, but not engaged, then he doesn't focus on them as much because he wants to focus on people that want to change. That's how what I've heard anyway. I don't know that for a fact. I've never taken one of his classes. But how was that when you realized you were taking a class with somebody who had been to the, you know, world championships and everything? Was that intimidating for you to take that class for the first time? Or were you engaged in a mindset of, you know, this is who I have to learn from? What did that look like for you?
Well, I mean, so at the time, you know, he's been doing a podcast for a while. And so there's always that kind of feeling where you feel like, you know, when you spent, you know, hours listening to someone talk, even if it's one way, you sort of feel like you know someone.
Yep.
So there was a sort of familiarity there, but no, I mean, I definitely would agree that as any good instructor, he sort of feels out each person and he'll give you as much critique as he thinks you can take.
Okay.
And so to be someone who, you know, I like when he would say something, I wouldn't make an excuse. I'd just be like, oh, okay. And then you would see other people, he'd be like, you know, what's going on here? And they'd say, well, my gun, my blah, blah, blah. And you could tell they're just like, they weren't really incorporating what he was giving.
Right.
And so he would just kind of, you know, as with any instructor, it's like, you're not going to keep hammering on something if they're just not listening.
That's right.
But I also, you know, noticed early on as I started shooting, there were guys that were better than me, but that were not really paying attention to the details. They would shoot a bad stage and then they would just write it off. They wouldn't take it seriously. And then I'd see them a month later and they'd shoot another bad stage. And they were sort of caught in this loop of not learning from their mistakes.
Right.
So one of the things that I tried to make sure to do early on is don't just blow those things off. You know, treat even a small issue as indicative of something larger. And so, you know, to have somebody in a class, obviously, you know, getting that kind of feedback, I was just incorporating it and trying to act on it. And so when you do that, obviously as an instructor, you're going to say, okay, this guy's paying attention. Let me, you know, give him more because he's not necessarily more time or more attention, but honestly, you know, more honesty.
Right. Being honest with himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, just saying like, hey, that wasn't very good. And it's like, yeah, you're right. Like, and here's why, you know, but not just being mean for its own sake.
No, no.
But
no, I never heard that.
But no, I mean, you definitely, being someone in the sport, I mean, again, it was very strange coming in and relatively quickly rising and seeing people who had been in the sport for 10 years longer than me, who were active participants, but not really, you know, striving that much to get better. Because, you know, to some degree, this is just their weekend time and that's fine.
Yeah. And because there's some people that want to take a class with somebody to be around them, just be closer to those people as well. So, I mean, I've seen it. So I know what you're talking about. But it takes a lot for when you train somebody to find out what motivates certain people. Mm. So from his motivation that came to you, have you had motivational training like that before at other jobs you've worked to take that kind of criticism or take that, you know, to be able to hear somebody say, this is wrong, and here's why, and not baby you mm-hmm. over it. So that's not everybody can handle that kind of training, mm-hmm. unfortunately, especially in the world today we live in. It's more, sure. you know, we have to make sure now that there's unfortunately, even in the gun world, there's still more feelings involved.
Sure.
If somebody thinks they talked to them the wrong way, that they can't get over that. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of that before talking to people, but and you try to have the other conversation. Let's look at it from the other point of view. This is nothing personal. This person is just trying to identify the mm-hmm. differences. So did you have any kind of training like that growing up in other jobs you've worked or any kind of like that before? Is that the first time you've ever had heads on, like, I'm going to tell you exactly how it is kind of training?
I mean, not specifically. I mean, you always have sort of a relationship with other people, and the more honest you can be, sort of the fewer layers of kind of intermediary, you know, nicety that you have to speak through, the more honest you can be, and the quicker you can kind of get to the point.
Okay.
And, you know, that's always something you appreciate with your close friends, is you can just, you don't have to dance around it. You can just be like, hey, you know, this was wrong, or mm-hmm. this really hurt me, or, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, so, you know, having that relationship, or just being able to interact on that wavelength, mm-hmm. I mean, it was honestly, it's a relief, right? I'm not much of a conversationalist small talk kind of guy. So just being able to get down to brass tacks and say, you know, here's what's going on, here's what you need to do, get to it. I was like, great. You know, I wasn't making excuses. I was just making notes and, mm-hmm. and, you know, coming up with my training plan and, you know, not trying to justify why I was doing the wrong thing, but just moving on.
Cool. Did y'all become close because of those classes? Is that how you pretty much got conversations started off the air, being part of his group and stuff? I'm not sure if he had a training group back then, but was that something that he stayed in touch with you after the training classes, or you just saw each other during training classes based on y'all's relationship that you had from early on?
I mean, it was sort of an intermittent thing, you know, maybe once or twice a year, swap some emails about something or, you know, we, especially, you know, as time went on, you know, and there were various, you know, with the president election leading up into 2016, mm-hmm. you know, obviously he was on his podcast and, you know, we would correspond a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, it was never really, you know, we don't talk all the time or anything.
Right. What got you excited when you went from B&B class and then master class? Where did your emotions go to get through that process? Was it exciting, or was it a process of, this is just what I have to do? You know, because the reason I'm asking that question is just, I listen to your podcast all the time, and your tone is the same. No matter what's happening, mm-hmm. excited, not excited, your tone stays pretty much relatively the same. Mm-hmm. So what excites you? What motivates you mm-hmm. to get you in a different level where you get excited? What does that look like compared in relation to the shooting sports?
I think it's being able to sort of make progress, to learn things, you know, to have those aha moments and mm-hmm. then be able to identify them to help others. You know, I had a brief stint where I was trying to teach some classes locally. Mm-hmm. I ended up doing, I think, 5 or 6 of those, and I enjoyed the heck out of it, but it was extremely draining. And I just, you know, had other things. I couldn't sort of sustain the pace. Mm-hmm. But being able to sort of give back and take what I'd learned and help other people sort of see the path. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, just trying to set things, to create the structure in which, you know, people can be successful.
Okay.
So, you know, if I see a way that, hey, this is something that works really well at our club, you know, let's try and share it out, or, you know, here's something that's worked for me as a shooter. So at the sort of micro level and the structural level, if there's something that we can do, whether it's something that I've found or something someone's told me about, mm-hmm. but if we can sort of share that, make the sport better, make the experience more satisfying for mm-hmm. whatever the goal is, right? Whether it's the people who just want to show up and shoot with their buddies on the weekend,
right.
or the people that want to grind hard, or the people that need to shoot a gun for a living. I mean, all of these people have a home in the sport, mm-hmm. and trying to find a way that they can, that we can sort of make something that satisfies all of them, is just interesting to me. It's a process, and it's always changing, but you can also always be improving.
Right. I agree with that. You made a comment that it was draining when you were doing training courses. Mm-hmm. What was the draining part?
Just like getting to the range, 45 minutes, so I'd have to leave my house at like 6 a.m. to get there, to set up at 7 for the class to start, and then be walking around and talking to people for 8 hours, and then, tear down and wouldn't get home until after dark. And, that was a whole Saturday. Mm-hmm. And then, everything else would kind of bunch up on Sunday. So I enjoyed the heck out of it. It was very satisfying, but it was just something that, it got really the other thing is it was sort of eating into my own practice time. So, I ended up, it was to the point where between, that day I was so drained. I didn't want to go to practice after that. Mm-hmm. And I was actually, I was signed up and I went down to Florida to shoot the IPSC Nationals in 2018.
Okay.
I'd shot it in 2017. I enjoyed it. I found it a really interesting change of pace. Obviously it's, the IPSC rules, run things a little bit differently. And I was just shooting that match, and I knew, I was like, I should not be here. I'm not nearly as prepared. I'd scheduled it. I'd wanted to be here, but I just hadn't put in the work. And that match just generally was a really negative experience. And that was kind of the turning point where I said, okay, I can either do the classes and all my stuff, keep up with my job at work and my family and everything. I can either go the instructor route or I can go the individual competitor route, but I can't really do both, not right now. And so that's when I sort of shifted my focus back to being an individual competitor.
Cool. When you met your wife, were you shooting then?
Yeah, we met at a shooting match.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Mm-hmm. She was a shooter then, I'll take it, right? What was she shooting?
So we met at an IDPA match.
Okay.
Of all things. But, once a bunch of us from that IDPA match were shooting the Sir Walter USPSA match later that week. And so we sort of said, hey, you should come shoot this. And, I even loaned her some extra magazines and she came out and enjoyed that. And that's, I think that was her first USPSA match. And then, we got stalking after that and the rest is history, but
that's so cool. How long have you been together now? So you've been together almost 12, well, no, 10.
So that would have been 2015 that we would have met.
Okay.
We got married 2016.
2016. Sweet. Yeah. So coming up on 8 years then. So 9 years. I don't know. I can't do math. That's too too many fingers involved. But that's cool. So did she continue to shoot with you for a while? Or is that something where she just said, I got other things to do hobby wise? What did that look like?
No, yeah. We kept shooting together for a while. Honestly, the thing that, as you can imagine, kind of put a damper on it was when our first kid came along.
Oh gosh. Kids. I was one and done. You might've heard the story before. they could turn your life upside down. Great things. My son's wonderful, but 30 years old when I was setting my ways too much. So an experience.
No, I mean, it's, I wouldn't trade it for anything. And to some degree it's something that, so it's an interesting setup because she's still the North Carolina section coordinator.
Oh, okay.
Because that's a position, and so she comes out, she is the match director of the, co-match director of the state championship every year. Mm-hmm. And so she's still actively involved in the sport, and we talk through things and discuss, but at the end of the day she has the background in the sport and kind of can keep in touch with all the clubs and all the match directors to kind of do that job. I don't think it's not something she stopped wanting to do. It's just, we got to figure out the family logistics to
life happens,
drop the kids off at grandma's and go out to a match. And honestly, a lot of the matches around us, it's an all day thing,
right?
Especially some of these longer matches. Yeah. And, that's something that I'd like to have a discussion, within the USPSA community of sort of how can we make our matches more efficient?
Right.
I think there are a lot of ideas out there, but I think, I hear a lot of folks that I know that either shoot matches and then either get out of it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. One of the big complaints is, I'm there for 4, 5, 6 hours and, I'm shooting for 3 minutes or something like that.
Right.
And, I can understand that.
No, I get it. Your wife being a section coordinator, she could actually be appointed an area director if that ever came up. Has she ever realized that that could be a possibility one day she could be appointed or be asked to be an area director?
I mean, we've talked about it. It's, stranger things have happened, but you know, I mean,
you're telling me
Area 6 is a big area, and it is a big area. I imagine one of the other section coordinators probably would step up, but right. You know, anything could happen.
Well, that's cool. Being a family that's totally involved in the shooting force, I apologize. I just didn't know your wife did that. That's wonderful. Does that bring home the sport sometimes too much for table discussion, where it gets like just a lot of discussions like, okay, I'm tired of hearing this kind of thing, 'cause this is what we talk about all the time, especially with some of the stuff going on.
So far, not really.
Okay.
Mostly okay. It'll be when there's, you know, especially when the section match is coming up and there's a bunch of work to be done, mm-hmm. you know, we start talking about, I'll say, oh, you know, what do you think about, you know, we could do a stage like this. And she's like, don't talk to me about that right now.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Like, you know, she has time when she's, you know, working on section stuff.
Oh, I get it. 'Cause if I'm at the lab and Sherry comes to work, I leave. I don't even want to be there because we're going to, it's not even butt heads. It's just, I don't want to hear questions of like, hey, why are we doing it this way? I'm like, well, you aren't here. This is why, but I'm going to get my hair cut. Be back in an hour. Yeah. So I get that kind of concept of working together. That's why I asked that question. If it's ever been a situation of like, okay, she has her, you know, for lack of a better word, she has her role. You've got your role, and that just, you just handle it that way. Correct.
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool. When did you realize that what was the moment you realized you wanted to be more involved? You know, you start off doing the training. You know, we talked about classes you started taking, then you worked your way up to, you know, grandmaster after 3 years, and you're hitting goals, in other words. What moment clicked with either you and or your wife's conversation where you said, I want to take charge and be in more control of what we're doing in North Carolina? What did that look like for the conversation? Because, you know, there's a real thing I see happen with people I talk to every weekend. And I run across conversations where somebody would say, I burn out. I left the sport for 3 years and I came back. And I don't think you have. So what, you know, what stopped you from, you know, saying we need to take a break and reverse that and say, okay, we're going to get even more involved? What was that conversation like?
I mean, it basically just came down to sort of as time progressed and, you know, various sort of small and large crises would unfold. The option was basically hope that somebody else is going to step up and solve this problem, or step up and do it yourself.
Okay.
So, for example, the series of circumstances that led to Stephanie becoming section coordinator was that in 2018, the section match was, we'd had a new section coordinator. He'd come in, he'd had all these grand plans for what the section match was going to be. He was saying mini nationals, it's going to be this, that, and the other. And we ended up getting a hurricane coming straight up the middle of the state in the very week that the match was happening. And so he ended up canceling it the Tuesday, you know, we were supposed to start set up the next day, that kind of thing. And that was the right call. That was totally the right call. And then people were like, okay, cool. Match is canceled. When do I get my refunds? And he said, no refunds. All the money's spent.
Oh
yeah.
That went over like I'm not even gonna say what it went over like, but that's not good.
Right. And basically after that, it was untenable. And so he basically said, and by the way, I resign effective immediately. And so at that point there was sort of this question of, well, okay, so we need a new section coordinator.
Yeah.
Who's, you know, all the match directors were, you know, already feeling like you're saying, like on the edge of burnout, you know, already feeling kind of overstressed.
Yeah.
And so none of them really wanted to step up and do it. And I remember standing in our kitchen and, you know, her and I kind of talking it over and the discussion about, you know, what would it take to do this? You know, because originally it was like, well, should I step up, do it and do it? And her thought was, you know, it really is more of a logistical role. Like at the end of the day, most section coordinator roles, it is, you know, making sure the trains run on time, making sure people get their national slots, making sure, you know, when clubs don't pay their dues, they get notices, you know, it was a logistical thing. And her attitude at the time was that, you know, she wanted me to be freed up to continue competing, to continue, you know, driving in the sport and having an effect at, you know, the stage design level and trying to help at the club. And so she, you know, we kind of agreed among ourselves that, that she was actually the right one to kind of put her name forward. And,
wow.
You know, the other, there were a few other names put forward and the match directors in the state agreed that, that she would be the best candidate. Mm-hmm. And, she's been the section coordinator ever since.
How many years has that been now?
So yeah, that would have, she would have taken over middle of 2018. So this will be her. So she, yeah, she planned the 2019 state match. So this will be her fifth time running.
Wow.
State match. And you know, it's working.
Right.
You know, nobody's, agitating, you know, that, that she needs to be kicked out and replaced with somebody else.
Right.
And so when last year, when everything kind of was unfolding with the board, mm-hmm. It was a similar situation where I was looking around and saying, something's gone wrong. Somebody needs to step up. And, mm-hmm. And we were having that same conversation about, well, if nobody steps up, maybe it has to be me.
Right.
And so that's when, you know, we talked about it and I announced that I was running for Area 6.
And this is something y'all discussed about, okay, if we do this, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny coming from both sides. Well, good and bad, in other words, because, you know, there's, when was the moment that, you know, I, like I said, I heard about you through the incidents that happened back when the previous president was here. Mm-hmm. You can do your research through social media and find that out yourself. But when was the moment where it seemed like you were on the outside of the board? If that makes any sense, being like, you know, like something's not, well, like the impression that I got talking to other people through process is that you had a different direction from where everybody else is wanting to go. Mm-hmm. And you know, the board don't, they didn't back then. There's new more board members coming in. Sure. Things are changing. But there was a time where that was like, you've lost your mind, mm-hmm. kind of mentality. They did not have the, and some of them still don't have the capacity to listen,
yeah.
to go through that process and understand, having a conversation like you and I are doing, to really understand what somebody is really about,
sure.
to make different changes. Did you have that moment of when the script kind of flipped?
Yeah, I mean, well, it had been an ongoing series of sort of head scratching my head at the decisions being made.
Okay.
Everything from, you know, in production, classifying a hammer as a minor internal component that could be swapped for aftermarket when a hammer is obviously not an internal component to a handgun. Mm-hmm. You know, from there all the way up to all the tinkering being done with production, the way they handled carry optics with the weight limit and the changes from being a 10-round division to 140, and just all of these decisions. That just every time it just seemed like there was a part of the conversation that was happening in these board meetings that was missing. And, you know, the one that finally was the thing that tipped me over. And this was influenced by the fact that I knew that the election for Area 6 was coming up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, last summer when the board moved to suspend and ban people just for saying controversial stuff on the internet.
That's right.
That's when I thought, okay, we've crossed a line. This mm-hmm. has gone from cheating on the range, which in the past has arguably not been taken as seriously as it should have been.
Okay.
To taking off the range conduct that really fundamentally is meant to criticize people who are in a position of public service and punishing them by taking away their ability to participate in the sport, not because they've cheated, not because they've done anything that is actually personally threatening to anyone, but mm-hmm. simply for saying mean things on the internet.
Right.
And I thought, okay, this is a line. This isn't just a rules thing anymore. This is the board using power to get rid of people that they find difficult. And that is not a precedent that I want to be a part of.
Right.
To some degree, I don't want to be a part of an organization that is seen as banning critics for petty reasons.
Right.
Now, you can say they said this or they said that, but the fact of the matter is the impression that everybody outside of our sport has right now is that people said mean stuff on the internet and then they got banned.
100% agree. I've talked to people in other sports. You are not wrong. I hear it I hear it from other sports all the time because they know I'm really involved with USPSA being the official eyewear and everything else. I hear it and they're like going, so what's going on over there? What's really happening? I'm like going, there's a lot to that I don't know the answer to. And some of that stuff doesn't make sense to me either. So I know what you're talking about. Let's take another break because I want to analyze that a little bit more so people really understand where you're coming from and what you're wanting to do as an area director. Because from what I understand, it's not what everybody's trying to make you out to be, of trying to, you know, change the entire sport and get rid of steel challenge. That's not the case. So I want people to really listen and understand what your message is so it's not skewed. And I think that's very important. So let's take a final break from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with you. And we'll finish up some important conversation from Ben Berry. Hold on 1 second.
This week's podcast is also sponsored by Make Ready Nutrition. They have 3 products available for shooters that are 2 Alpha Performance to drink before hammer down, 2 Alpha Recovery that I use personally as a meal replacement for lunch with 34 grams of protein and is low carb, 2 Alpha Ammunition, which is next level hydration plus energy and amino acids for shooters, gym workouts, or pushing your body in sports and recreation. Whether you're in the Texas heat or in Arizona desert, 2 Alpha Ammunition works harder and endures longer. This unique formula is manufactured for shooters by shooters to replenish your body with electrolytes and hydration while helping aid in muscle recovery and providing fast energy. For 25% off your next order, go to makereadynutrition.com/discount/huntershd or enter huntershd at checkout for 25% off your entire order. makereadynutrition.com. Are you ready?
So we'll get back into it where your vision for one being area director, which is a very important position that has been brought to everybody's attention inside the USPSA based on what was not being done or discussed prior, because the previous president had full control of everything without, you know, having to go through all the barriers. And some other board members back then may or may have not have had as much passion to look completely through the process to understand if it was right or wrong, and just made decisions to, for lack of better words, go along because they trusted other board members to tell them the right thing that was happening. And a lot of stuff has been exposed. And now we're seeing where there may or may not be issues with finances. There may or may not be issues with how things are done. But the board has changed in a way where they're listening now. There's new board members coming in. There's a lot of new things. I'm very excited about the future just based on the transparency that is slow.
Agreed.
But is coming out more and more where they're being having to have meetings once a month instead of once a quarter. And then they're also, you know, have put things in place where rules can't be changed before nationals and can only be changed once a year. So we all know the stuff they've had to go through. And I don't think any of this would be exposed if we didn't have the unfortunate chain of events that we did have. That's been very, you know, testing to a lot of people. But I do see a light at the end of the tunnel. Where do you see yourself wanting to come in to complement some of the changes are being made and to even embroider or empower more people to get more, even more changes made? Where do you see your role there?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's it. That is, I want people to feel like as their area director, if they reach out to me, they won't just get, you know, a form, you know, okay, thanks for your opinion, you know, and get kind of blown off. That if there's a valid point, I'll sort of explain my thinking on it and be open to being, you know, convinced. Or, you know, if it's something where there are multiple points of view, I can represent those and say, you know, here's what I'm hearing from my members. I'm hearing A, B, and C. I think B is probably the best path, but I'm hearing A and C as well.
Right.
And having that element of being someone's representative, because ultimately that's what the directors are supposed to be. And so being, I, one of the reasons I try and talk about my opinions is on, you know, on my podcast and mm-hmm. my thoughts. It's not to say this is what is right and I cannot be convinced. It's that here's how I think about things. Mm-hmm. And if my argument is built on these three axioms and you disagree with one of them and you can point to me and say, actually, that's not correct. Well, then my argument is invalid. And so if I lay out how I think and then you can enlighten me or you can make a counter argument and you can actually educate me, I don't think decisions should be made by popularity contest. I don't think, you know, we should make any decision by 51% of the vote, you know, whether to change the calibration rule or add this to production or whatever it is.
Or 5% of the vote.
Or 5% of the vote.
On some other things that have happened lately. Yes.
It should be who's got the data, who's got the logic and the argument mm-hmm. to make the best case.
Right.
And I hope that from, you know, hearing my thoughts, hearing the way that I sort of analytically approach things and, mm-hmm. and the way that honestly, I don't, you know, I try not to have a lot of ego about things. I'm not hugely prideful. If I'm wrong about something, I try and say, here's where I'm wrong. Here's why I was wrong. You know, here's what I learned that corrected me. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid to admit that stuff because ultimately I'm not in this to, you know, for personal glory or anything. I want to be the representative and get to the truth.
When's the last time that happened where somebody contacted you and said, hey, I don't agree with this. Here's the point of view that I want you to look at. And it kind of changed your thought on something. Do you have any recall of last time that's happened to you?
That's a good one. I mean, so the one thing that comes to mind, just because it's, you know, it's on the brain is sort of production. You know, the idea that, you know, what should the production capacity be? You know, I've sort of long been an advocate for moving to production 15. That's mm-hmm. what started the whole thing with Foley in 2018. Mm-hmm. But you know, I've been having some discussions around, well, you know, whether, so, you know, my argument is that basically we don't want to turn, you know, if we go to something like, you know, whatever fits in the box, you know, you can add bass pads to that. Mm-hmm. We don't want to chase the extra capacity. And the argument that I've been hearing is, well, actually, the difference between, you know, a 17 round stock magazine, and let's say you put a bass pad on there and you get 19 or 20.
Yep.
That's a much smaller difference. If someone shows up to their first match and all they've got 17 rounders and the other guy's got 20s, it's a small difference, but they don't feel outgunned. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, okay. That's a fair point. You know, I could have my mind changed on that.
Okay.
You know, I still think, you know, for other reasons, there are perks to 15. I mean, aligning with IPSC, which were nominally the, you know, I mean, I see arguments on both sides, but that's sort of one that I've been sort of reconsidering based on what people have been saying to me.
Good deal. USPSA owns Steel Challenge. They, you know, are getting more of a voice now because they've even added committees mm-hmm. to the Steel Challenge, which I think is wonderful because they pulled in three people that are not on the board, that are three different identities mm-hmm. in different parts of the country that are very passionate about Steel Challenge to be a committee to talk to Zach Jones. Mm-hmm. Do you think that should be, that practice is healthy, or do you think, you know, you think USPSA should adopt some kind of the same practice?
100%.
Okay.
The idea is when you vote, you know, for an area director, what you're voting for fundamentally is someone with character and discretion, but you're not expecting them to necessarily have subject matter expertise in mm-hmm. all the things that a director needs to have.
Right.
As directors, we need to say, hey, we need help. You know, for example, take multi-gun, right? If we want USPSA to be the premier multi-gun rule set mm-hmm. in the US or potentially outside the US, we're not going to do it by only talking to existing USPSA shooters.
Right.
We need to bring in subject matter experts and formalizing that as a committee. I mean, we have a multi-gun committee. Mm-hmm. Adam Maxwell, I think, was just added.
Yes.
You know, so bringing in these outside subject matter experts who can, the board can say, here's a question. Here's an analysis I would like done. Mm-hmm. What should we do? What are the options? Present some pros and cons. And come back with some expertise from people who, whether it's, you know, Steel Challenge or multi-gun or any of these sort of specializations, mm-hmm. we can't expect every director to be an expert in everything. But what we want is to charge the committees with being with sort of preparing the information and then making the decision based on what the committees present. Mm-hmm. I think, to be completely honest, I think the only reason we don't see more of that is, for whatever reason, the board doesn't want people more aware of the inner workings of USPSA.
Right.
I mean, that's the only thing that really adds up, is why keep it. You look at the committee assignments, and it's just musical chairs. It's just them reassigning, you know, these three directors on that committee, these three directors on that committee. Right. Steel Challenge is really the one exception where they really have gone out and brought in members who don't have, you know, something to hide or mm-hmm. or whatever, and they're actually involving everyday members. And I think that's absolutely the way that it should be done. Mm-hmm. We should not expect directors to be subject matter experts in everything, but be willing to admit what they don't know, ask questions, take feedback, take the judgment. When if you get something presented to you that doesn't make sense, say, well, you say this here, but that over there, how does, you know, what's the difference? How does this square up? Mm-hmm. Be that sort of analytical, discretionary mind, and then take that information into the final vote.
Okay.
But I think involving more people at the sort of information gathering and wisdom generating level of the decision-making process is, I mean, there's no way the organization can keep growing if everything has to be done in the brains of eight, you know, part-time people, mm-hmm. not even part-time. I mean, volunteer, you know,
with, Area 6 being huge in Steel Challenge, what message do you have for the voters that are going to be, you know, I believe a huge part of the decision process for the Area 6 director? Mm-hmm. What message do you have for Steel Challenge shooters?
I think it would just be that hopefully you can hear from the way I talk about issues on this podcast, on my own podcast. I don't have a ton of background in mm-hmm. Steel Challenge. I've shot a few club matches here and there. I don't have the subject matter expertise, but I want to be informed. When there's a decision, I want to hear the case for this option, the case for that option, and then go and represent that to the board. Mm-hmm. Because that would be my job as area director, is taking what my members tell me, mm-hmm. filtering it through, you know, this argument doesn't really make a lot of sense, but here's what I'm hearing, you know, that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. but presenting what I'm hearing and saying, this is what my members want, this is what I think makes sense, and being their advocate, even if it's something that I don't have a ton of personal experience in, just because, again, I can only be in so many places at so many times.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at the amount of activity that is happening across the country in Area 6, I mean, the number of people, the number of matches, I mean, it's staggering. It's humbling.
Yes.
And I think, you know, we need an information mechanism that can bubble up the things being learned at ranges all across the country into mm-hmm. into some decision-making apparatus. And I'm, you know, that's my role. That's what I see it as, is, mm-hmm. again, when I talk on my podcast about things that I have an opinion on, those are just the things that I've sort of sat down and looked at and weighed the pros and cons. But, you know, some aspect of Steel Challenge that I haven't thought about, but, you know, I want to hear both sides of, then I can do that, and I can present that view. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard anything that needs to be changed in Steel Challenge, or is everything running, you know, from your opinion, based on what you hear at local and everything else, everything's pretty good, don't touch anything?
I'll be honest, the main thing that I've heard was the sign up last year for World Speech Shoot was a mess with practice score going down, and that they fixed it this year.
Right.
And I don't know the details of what was done, but good job, Zach Jones, Steel Challenge folks. I mean, whatever was done, I heard that it was much better this year.
Okay.
But no, I mean, honestly, that's the thing, is I don't run in those circles, but I want to be informed about that. I don't. Right. You know, it's one of those things where even if I were to go shoot my, you know, my local Steel Challenge club match, mm-hmm. I'm sure I would, you know, learn some things. But really what's been very interesting about putting my name in for area director and running the podcast and everything is the number of contacts I get from people in Area 6 and outside, just people who feel like their voice isn't being heard, and just getting a different perspective on things. You know, there's some parts of the country like North Carolina, South Carolina, where people are coming in, people are moving in. Mm-hmm. There are parts of the country where people are leaving. And those are parts where they're having trouble filling up matches, because they're not growing. They're not seeing the kind of growth we are. And now, obviously, that's, you know, that's not narrowly an Area 6 concern, although I'm sure within Area 6 there are some states that are gaining and some metro areas that are gaining and losing and that sort of thing. But, it's just getting the overall perspective that being connected by the internet and being able to have these discussions allows, I think is very powerful. And, I'll be honest, like everybody that says, I put my phone number, in my signature, give me a call. There, you can only have so many phone calls in a day, but right. I can read 20 emails. I can read 30 emails. Now I might not be able to respond to, in depth to every single one of them, but I can at least gather that information. And so this idea that, if you want to get anything done, you got to call someone on the phone. I mean, it is good to have a phone call if it's possible, but it's just not scalable when you're trying to represent thousands of members.
Well, yeah, and that's another point, because we are reaching over, or not reaching, we have access, we as a USPS organization, not me directly, but have access to over 35,000 people. And we send out surveys that one may be too long, may be done, they were done at last minute, they were, something's put together. But to only get a response from 5% on the biggest question that was answered, do you see people at your local range that don't want to be bothered by all this? They just want to shoot?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think there always needs to be a place for that. I think, for example, things like having the rules change infrequently, to whatever degree is possible, is a benefit. Because when people feel like the rules are changing all the time, and they're not keeping up with, the evergreen rule book in the app, they become more hesitant about calling rules calls because they're not actually sure what the current rules are.
Right.
To some degree, to where possible, we should make it so that people who just want to show up and shoot a club match, get their classifier, and go home. If that's the level that they want to participate at, we shouldn't discourage that. If they don't want to have an opinion, if they just want to, whatever the limited optics rules end up being, they'll either shoot it or they won't. That's a perfectly viable way to be a member, in my opinion. Within any group, there'll always be, some group that's more engaged. I think there've been some really interesting charts from some of these third party guys that are scraping practice score data, showing the number of people that shoot one club match a year versus 10 versus 20, and it's, there's always going to be this huge tail of sort of people that are not as engaged, and that's fine. I want the sport to be is if they show up 1 year and shoot a club match and they show up a year later and shoot another club match, it's basically the same.
Right.
They don't really have to, relearn a whole bunch of rules unless there's something really overridingly important that requires change.
Okay.
But yeah, to me, having the sport be as stable as possible so that people who do just want to, participate and not really get involved at the national level, that is a mandate that that is something that we need to keep in mind.
Let me piggyback off that one thing you said back how you got started with your turning point. Do you feel that our national events, be it there's too many of them or there's not enough, however you look at that, it's fine. But your turning point was when you went to nationals as a B-class shooter. Do you think that is very important to have more people have the same experience as you, or has it become so big that we can't sustain it anymore?
Well, so, I think there's a few things there. One is, for example, one of the things that I've proposed is if we had a nationals that was more competitive to get into in the main match, that if I were in that situation, bear in mind, in retrospect, I probably could have just paid my match fee and gone to nationals as B-class, but I didn't because I wanted this opportunity to work. And I saw this opportunity to sort of be involved and not necessarily give back. Like it was sort of selfish of me. Like, yeah, I get a free trip to nationals. I get to go shoot. I get to see all this stuff. Like there was a selfish aspect to it, but the rewards of it were motivating to me.
Right.
And so if it were a situation where that B-class guy can't, doesn't earn a slot into nationals because they're, fewer of them or they're more competitive or whatever reason. But there's this option to show up and work to say, hey, I want to be a part of this, not as a main competitor, but as someone who shoots on staff day. So I get to compare my scores to the big guys. But, I also give back in this way. I think there's a natural benefit there, because then we also give those guys a place to put their energy into the sport. Mm-hmm. You know, to some degree, I think a lot of the issues with nationals right now are the fact that, yes, there are, you know, we're sort of spreading the staff so thin, but it's also that, honestly, to just pay your match fee if you can get in. Now, mm-hmm. Carry Optics is a good example where a lot of people signed up to work that one because it was so hard to get a slot as a regular person.
Yes.
So I think we're going to see an interesting dynamic with the staff who work Carry Optics, mm-hmm. because that was an example of kind of what I've been talking about with, if slots are harder to get, then a secondary way to participate in the match would be to work it. I think if I had just shown up and as a B-class guy and just shot nationals and just only really seen the people on my squad, I don't think it would have had the same effect.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was something about seeing the whole thing from, you know, showing up the day before when targets were being hung to, you know, shooting on staff and then actually seeing all the squads come through, seeing the awards dinner and everything, like, mm-hmm. seeing the whole system was what kind of woke me up. But
so I don't know the numbers because I never asked, but based on what you're telling me, and making sure I understand, you feel that to go to nationals and work staff should be like a prerequisite for the A B shooters, C class shooters, to experience what they're going to have go through on a pre-match, which is the staff match, mm-hmm. to learn. And then the main match is different for people that have got to a certain level. Is that one way to look at it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to skin the cat. You know,
there where I was going with that is, you know, Troy chooses the staff. And Troy has even said on his show that they do, that he has a certain group of people that he likes to have with him because they're used to how things get set up. They're used to a pattern. Mm. Everything stays the same. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he knows what he's dealing with. So I guess the challenge would be to change up how they choose staff in a certain way to get more people in that don't have a chance to do staff, like some kind of lottery system or something, to make it where it throws more people in there to be able to do that. Because, you know, we've both been to a lot of nationals and we see a lot of the same people. Mm-hmm. So that's almost like it's a different kind of hard thing to get into based on, one, the needs, but two, also certain levels of comfort zone of Troy, it sounds like, the DNROI. So that may be something to look at. Yeah, as well, to get more people in. I'm not sure how that would be changed to an area director, but it's maybe something that just came to light just talking to me, that something, hey, are we too much in a comfort zone not to bring in new people to do staff? Because then there's also the other side of that, where somebody's may not be as qualified, mm-hmm. to be an RO, mm-hmm. and that nobody wants to admit that, but they realize that, you know, all of a sudden, oh, well, these people are a lot faster than I've ever seen before. Now I've got to, you know, be in charge of that. So there's two ways to look at that. Because if you keep the same ROs and you've got an experienced staff that's going to be consistent, but it's not allowing new people to come in to have that aha moment like you had.
Right.
So there's a lot to unfold there. I don't even know. That's just kind of me rambling. I'm not even sure there deserves an answer. Well, it's just a comment.
I mean, I think the underlying principle there is everything needs to be a system. It can't be dependent on one person. It can't be dependent on sort of individual reputation. You need to have the ability where every nationals, something like, you know, 10% of your ROs, mm-hmm. 20%, whatever your attrition rate is, you need to have at least that much new blood coming in and have a system where you assign the new guy to the veteran and they work together and there's some system there. There's some pipeline so that it's not just, yeah, let's just keep using the same people we've always used. Well, eventually that system's going to fall apart.
Yes.
You need, you know, we're not, to some degree, putting on a nationals is putting on a nationals, but it's also exists in sort of a cycle where every nationals feeds into the next one.
Yeah.
And the reputation built from one feeds into the next one. And so, you know, we can't just look at each individual event on its own. we have to look at this of like, what's the pattern that we're building? What is the cycle that we are mm-hmm. fostering? And if the cycle is, you know, people work a match and then they realize, wow, this is a ton of work. I can just, you know, pay my match fee and not have to do all this. And then they do that. And then the only people who work are the people, you know, I mean, this match is a great example because this is we're at the South Carolina section. Mm-hmm. It's a staff reset match. And it's a lot of people that probably, I mean, it's not like they couldn't afford to shoot the match fee,
right?
But the people here, they want, whether they're local to South Carolina or they want to give back, they want to contribute to an excellent experience. And mm-hmm. it's going to be an excellent experience. This is going to be a match that I think people are talking about,
right?
Because it's doing something different.
All right.
There's a certain, you know, personality type that wants to be a part of something like that, where mm-hmm. it's not just about the dollars and cents,
right?
But it's about, hey, I, you know, this is something special. I want to be a part of this.
Right.
And to be honest, I don't know that we're having that culture among the national staff.
You have to want to take pride.
Pride. Yeah.
In being a nationals event, because it's a lot more work. It's a lot more intensity. And you can say volunteer all day long, but you're still being compensated for being there. If it's hotel or something, you sure. know, it's a paid event. But, you know, I think it takes pride that you want to do it, because South Carolina's got a huge pride
yeah.
group here. That's one of the things I've noticed, even the matches in North Carolina I've been to. There's a huge group of pride. Unfortunately, it's not like that other places I go to sometimes, because people are just there because they, you know, were asked to come in, stuff like that. So there's a different sure. level of pride.
And I think that exists at the national level, too.
Yes.
There's a part of me that is not proud to be a part of the USPSA of the last few years, mm-hmm. where I can invest my time and my toil to build up the brand of USPSA, but if mm-hmm. I feel like it's on a larger scale being squandered and going towards supporting, you know, people that are making the wrong decision, mm-hmm. then I don't want to, even at the local level where I can have impact. And that's what, you know, what I've tried to do is mm-hmm. make positive changes, you know, at the club and the state level. People will do all kinds of work if they feel like it's for a good cause,
right?
Fundamentally.
Right.
But when people look at USPSA and they, you know, they wonder what the heck is going on, mm-hmm. then they're going to do something else. They're going to go volunteer to coach their kids' little league team, or, right. you know, they're going to volunteer to, you know, repaint houses or something. I mean, yeah. you know, people have finite time, and if you want them to come volunteer for you, mm-hmm. you have to be the most meaningful, most compelling way that they could spend that time. They have to feel like they are contributing to something excellent and great. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't feel that way about USPSA, which is a big shame.
It is. You came into the sport seeing a separate executive director mm-hmm. and a separate president. Then you experienced those roles being merged into one person mm-hmm. with the entire power. Are you a fan of where it's at now, where it's split back up, being an executive director and a president?
Yeah. I mean, I think structurally having someone that knows kinds of the nuts and bolts mm-hmm. as elected presidents come and go, mm-hmm. I think having that continuity is a good thing.
Okay.
I think having someone that, you know, knows
that doesn't change.
Well, I mean, they change, but on a different cycle from the president, mm-hmm. right? You know, especially with contentious elections or with someone, you know, being removed from office, there's mm-hmm. not necessarily that graceful transfer of power and knowledge.
Right.
Which is, you know, also an issue from other area directors I've heard, you know, is a lot of times, you know, if it's a contentious election, then they don't get a lot of support when they come in, you mm-hmm. know, of what is left there. And so, yeah, I think structurally having someone that is more of sort of the nuts and bolts day-to-day stuff, but mm-hmm. you know, reports to the president, and then having the president who really is meant to be the person with whom the buck stops, yeah. right?
But it doesn't, the executive director reports to the board now. That was a change.
Yeah.
So the president is I've said it before on other shows, is a glorified match director.
Yeah, with a board vote.
With a board vote, but you still have to play friendly with others.
Right. Yeah, I do think that there was a... Yeah, I don't... I haven't thought deeply about that change in structure. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, to me, the managing director should sort of be the president's eyes, ears, and arms. And then, you know, the board advises the president. But I mean, I certainly think if we want the sport to grow, which mm-hmm. I'm not sure everybody actually does. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are in the sport are actually kind of happy with the level that it's at.
Where are you at?
I think that USPSA can do great things for people in the sport, right? As something, as an activity to get people outdoors, mm-hmm. get some exercise, have a reason to practice, have a, you know, be something to motivate people to not just sit on the couch and play video games all the time. Mm-hmm. I think societally it's a place for people to practice with their, you know, if we carry guns are a weird situation because a lot of the way stages and divisions are set up, they're not mm-hmm. very friendly to actual carry guns. I think there's a discussion to be had there, but as a sport for people to at least, you know, get trigger time, practice shooting mm-hmm. quickly and accurately, I think there's value there.
100% agree with
that. I mean, there's USPSA is more than just guys shooting holes in cardboard. Like there's a larger role for us to play, but we can't do that with the way that a lot of the clubs, you know, are set up right now where, you know, there's just no more room. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we can print as many membership cards, as many membership numbers as we want. But as I've talked about before, if there's nowhere for them to go shoot, then the sport can't really grow.
Do you think there's no room for it to grow, really?
I think there's a huge amount of room for it to grow, but it will require adding matches, getting clubs that don't currently run matches, having some kind of way to expand the footprint of USPSA. Mm-hmm. You know, there are indoor ranges, you know, outdoor ranges. I mean, just having some kind of outreach where we're not just
you want to grow our club base.
Yeah, I mean, it's
important. Well, which I agree. Yes,
it has to be in sync with the membership base.
Okay,
you know, if you give a bunch of people membership numbers and then they don't have anywhere to go shoot, they're not going to renew.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that problem anywhere locally with you?
Just in the last few months. So I don't know what the turning point is.
Everybody gets to come in and bring their limited optics gun now. It brought everybody into the sport.
Well, but like in February.
Okay. Yeah. Continue. I'm sorry.
No, that'll be an interesting one. In February in North Carolina, which was it was a pretty cold February, we started to have matches filling up for the first time since primers really went crazy after COVID.
Okay.
And so I think primers are still expensive, but loaded ammo is coming down. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really the guys that, you know, this is why area and section, you know, level 2 and 3 participation never really dropped according to, you know, USPSA's graphs, but club level participation did. I think it was the 20, 30, 40% of people that just buy factory ammo and shoot and don't reload. Those people were really hard up and so they weren't able to get ammo. So they stopped shooting club matches, but that loaded ammo is coming back. I think again, I don't have the data, but you know, subjectively, that's what it looks like to me. Mm-hmm. And so those people are starting to show up and yeah, we're running out of room at USPSA club matches. I run an indoor action pistol match. That's mm-hmm. sort of USPSA like, but you know, we can put a few more restrictions on it just, so we don't have to build everything with props. We can just say, hey, you know, shoot this from here weekend or whatever. We fill up, it's a $20 match, it's 4 stages, and we fill up in 5 minutes. We fill up 30 slots. You know, we could probably run one of those every week and fill 30 slots.
So that's where I was going. As a business owner, if I'm filling a match up, I'm excited.
Yeah.
Because then I want to figure out how to add another stage.
Right.
Or add another day.
Right.
As a business owner.
Right.
Because that brings more income for the club.
Right.
Do people not have that same sense of excitement when it fills up? Because if I hear a club's filling up a club match as a business owner, that excites me. Mm-hmm. That means I got to grow.
Right.
And if I don't grow, you're right. People don't have anywhere to shoot and we're stagnated.
Right.
So is that responsibility of USPSA or the club owner? Match director.
Yeah, I don't think this is something that, you know, we can fix with a tweak to the rule book.
Agree. I'm just talking about If the USPSA is doing this to grow the membership cards mm-hmm. going out,
right,
and another club is, like I said, filling up in 20 minutes mm-hmm. or 5 minutes, whatever it is,
right?
Does that not excite the club owner/match director to make it bigger?
In a lot of cases, no. I mean, you know, a lot of cases, well, if it's, so if, you know, take a club that's run at a gun club where all the money goes to the gun club and, you know, you could run an additional stage, but then that's it, well, or maybe you're using every bay at the club. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you could run a second match in the month, but then that's a weekend that you're running a second match instead of, you know, your weekend off to go shoot someone else's match, you know, because the structure of it. In a lot of places now, you know, some clubs have, you know, more help than others and that sort of thing. But I mean, you know, for me, for example, this indoor match that I run, you know, the range is happy to have us and take the money. But, you know, for me, it's not something I want to spend every Monday night doing, putting this match on for everyone else. Mm-hmm. Cause I'm not, I mean, it doesn't make a huge amount of money for me. It doesn't make any money for me. Mm-hmm. It's fun that I get to go shoot it, but you're never really shooting at your best as, you know, when you're running around, running the timer.
But there's nobody else to step up and do the match another day?
Well, that's the thing, is we would need to sort of start this mentorship pipeline and you know, sort of raise people up and have this culture of, and I don't know when this happened, but I think, you know, we definitely are at a spot where I feel like people, you know, they just want to pay their money on practice score, show up, shoot their stages, get their scores on the way home. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel the same as, you know, when I started 10 years ago, and maybe this is subjective, maybe it's rose tinted glasses. I don't know, but there's definitely this feeling of when people see, you know, well, you know, why would I volunteer unless, you know, I'll do the minimum I have to, I'll pay my match fee. And, and I don't know how we fix that. I genuinely don't, because I want ideas.
Because that's what's got to happen. There has to be solutions for the clubs to realize, okay, if you're not getting paid, that's fine. But if you're running a match, is there anything that says you can't get paid?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not even trying to. I'm not debating.
Right.
I'm just trying to put a simple, like, if you treat it like a business,
right?
Because, you know, we have a business. If you own a club,
right,
and all of a sudden I'm full as a business owner, well, hell,
there's demand there.
I want something else because you've heard me talk about it 100 times on Tuesday night when I do my thing and everything else. The more people that come in, it's the more people that are engaged to use their firearm better, and it's more awareness for the Second Amendment.
Yes.
If we stagnate that,
yes,
that's concerning. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think, you know, and then I look at, you know, and do I hold the USPSA responsible for getting all these members in here? Well, no, that's what I want them to do. But do I hold the match, you know, do I hold a certain range accountable for, like, well, you need to, you know, do six bays instead of, you know, four. You need to go ahead and have a discussion with the owner and say, instead of him giving you four bays, get six.
Right.
You know, there's other discussion, and it's not an answer. This is just me. This is me ranting for a second, because I put it back on the club owner to say, well, if there's $20 out there, well, then maybe it needs to be 25. Mm-hmm. And maybe I need to, okay, if I'm going to do this two nights a week, maybe that extra $5 goes to me and my time.
Right.
The shooter don't care.
Right.
The shooter wants to go shoot a match and then be educated. And then that leads to training. That leads to, you know, when you did training classes, Ben, all these people that do training classes, the more they get out there and shoot, the more they want to train. So that's where I'm at. So I won't rant. It's your show, but I just want to let you know I hold that accountable back to the business owner.
No, I totally agree. Well, and that's the thing, is in a lot of cases, it's not a business. It is a nonprofit gun club or something like that.
But then it goes back to the business owner of the club going, okay, USPSA, how can you help me?
Right. Well, and so this is a good solution there as well. Yeah, this is a good example. You know, one of the interesting conversations I've had in the last few weeks is, you know, someone talking about the experience at ranges near them, where the range was looking to start various shooting sports, and they reached out to the national organization and said, hey, what do I need to run one of your matches?
Right.
And they basically didn't, you know, from some of these other matches they got, hey, here's the checklist.
Yes.
Here's what you need to do. And from USPSA, I don't know exactly what they got, but it wasn't like that.
No.
So, you know, to some degree, it's when you get those inbound leads, obviously an inbound lead from a potential, you know, customer, that's picking low hanging fruit. But, you know, there are success stories. I mean, there's a club out across the bay from San Francisco, Richmond Rod and Gun Club, where I believe our president Eamon Lin's involved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have a whole structure where, because there aren't that many clubs, they do something, I think, almost every weekend there. They have like two USPSA matches and they have practice nights.
In the great free state of California.
Well, but it's
exactly,
but
they're doing it.
But I think, you know, we could learn a lot from them.
Right.
Say, what is it that you guys do? What are the lessons learned? What's, you know, what should we, if someone does want to, you know, grow a club like that, mm-hmm. you know, how do we do it?
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to things like making, you know, making the actual nuts and bolts easy for multiple people to do. So, mm-hmm. you know, having this, you know, some clubs have a rotating match director or something mm-hmm. like that, so that it could be something that's shifted around. But yeah, I mean, at a certain point, it's up to the people at the match. And again, I'm as guilty of this as anyone, because I, you know, helped put on this match, but I don't really, you know, I'm not taking people and saying, hey, you need to learn how to run the timer, or you need to learn how to do stage design mm-hmm. so that I can hand it off to them and run another match in the month. But that, you know, something in there needs to be happening.
100% agree.
And, you know, I think if we can grow USPSA to the level where, you know, it's an option all the time, right? You have multiple weeknight matches and, mm-hmm. you know, if they're indoor ranges near you, there's an outdoor match every weekend within an hour's drive of anyone that wants to shoot it, right. That kind of thing. If we can get the sport to that level, then yeah, let's keep growing the membership. But just throwing more members at club matches that have no capacity, it's an issue, and it's a cultural issue. It's not a rules issue. It's not a procedural issue, but right. It's something that we got to figure out. How does the sport keep growing
right.
without just guys stepping up and, you know, starting a new match that,
well, yes, I agree. We're not going to solve the problems today, but it's definitely up for discussion. And I think it goes back to responsibility, like I said before, of both parties, but it's there to be talked about.
And there's a huge demand. People want to shoot high quality matches.
I love it. I love it. I want the demand to be there even more. You know, I built the business off demand. Sure. I want it, but I mean, I want it for the Second Amendment too, because yes. we're having a lot of matches in areas that are not gun friendly. And to have that, it opens more people to say, what are you going to do this weekend? I'm going to shoot. Opens conversations. This one's been a little bit longer, and I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me, because I wanted to get a little history about where you came from and talk about stuff. Now, I do have one question that came to my mind a while ago. What do you think now the USPSA is doing right?
I mean, I definitely think, you know, for example, like you mentioned, the bylaws changes to kind of stabilize the rules and slow down the pace of change. Mm-hmm. I definitely think that has been a good thing.
Okay.
I mean, I think the, you know, the way that the discussion around limited optics has been, you know, there's been more transparency into that. You know, mm-hmm. there's been at least this survey system.
Yep.
I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, what is happening at the local level, the actual club level of the sport is mm-hmm. as healthy, I think, as it's ever been. Now,
good.
Like I said, I think we need, you know, we have seen this dip due to COVID and primers mm-hmm. and ammo shortage. That's sort of been a reprieve. I think we're going, you know, matches are going to be, you know, there's going to be an issue coming back with that coming back. But, I think we just need, you know, more, to actually have these discussions in public. We need to mm-hmm. have, you know, some transparency to know what is actually happening. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the financial state of,
I wasn't even going to say that long word because yeah. we don't know, yeah. but that will come to light.
But I think, I mean, at the end of the day, the sport, you know, for the people that actually are invested in it, I think mm-hmm. everybody still sees the value in what it is. We mm-hmm. all still want to be a part of this thing, mm-hmm. and there still is nothing else like it. You know, right. there are all these jokes about, oh, are you going to go shoot IDPA?
Right.
It's not the same thing.
No.
This is a just a raw test of speed and skill, and there's nothing like it. And yep. and I think we have something special here. And I, you know, everybody that's saying, oh, go make, you know, make another sport, jump to another rule set. No. This is worth fighting for. This
Good.
Is worth staying and fixing. And the problems took years to create, and they'll take years to fix. But yeah, I think at the core of the sport, there's still something really, truly excellent that's not like anything else that exists out there.
Wonderful. Any last things we didn't discuss you want to bring up?
No, I'll just plug the podcast. Yes. Short Course is my podcast. I put out a 25-minute episode every week.
Yeah, I wish it was longer. I drive a lot, though.
Well, I try. My goal is to pack, you know, an hour's worth of talking into 25.
You do. You
know?
Do a lot.
So that's what I do. And again, you know, you don't, they're not sequential. So jump around, look at the episode titles. If there's something interesting, mm-hmm. you know, look at that episode, give it a listen. and send me an email, ben@berryshooting.com.
Yep, because I'm in Area 6 myself, and there's a lot of people listening to this podcast in Area 6. You want people to contact you with questions, concerns, great ideas and stuff like that now,
yes,
before the election.
Yeah. I mean, heck, even if I don't win, I still, the contacts that I'm making, the perspectives that I'm getting, mm-hmm, that I can present on the podcast, that I can just raise and try and be a voice for. Mm-hmm. I want to be that conduit that people who feel like they don't have a voice, they don't have a representation, whether that's on the board, whether that's in the national discussion, mm-hmm, that I can at least sort of have some, you know, be a part of that. And so, you know, whether it's a question or just, hey, you know, here's how things run at my local match. This is what I found really interesting. This is what we do different. All of these things I find really interesting. And I think if we can aggregate these lessons to other clubs, there's a lot of opportunity for clubs to learn from each other. But again, you know, because it's a regional thing, people don't tend to cross pollinate unless someone like you, you know, driving across the country. Mm-hmm. But you know, match directors in one area tend to just shoot the matches near them and, you know, share ideas in that small sphere. So, mm-hmm, ideas spread slowly unless we use the power of the internet to do stuff like that. So yeah, send me, if there's a question that you have, if there's something interesting, some concern you see addressed, or, you know, just something you're curious about what my take on it would be. Yeah. Send me an email, ben@berryshooting.com. I love getting the one-on-one interaction and getting to hear what people are seeing and hear what's on their mind. Because, you know, social media is a highlight reel. It's all filtered. It's all posturing. But when it's just a one-on-one email, you know, there's nobody to impress. It's just a straight conversation between two people.
Right. Very well said. Well, thank you so much for watching or listening to Hunter's HD Gold Behind the Lens. Good luck to you, Ben, on your election and everything else. But if you have any questions, he's give you information on how to get in touch with him. Or you can email me at info@huntershdgold.com, and I'll make sure to get it to him myself. But until next time, please get out there, get involved, tell people about the shooting sports, and we'll see you at the range soon. Thanks again, Ben.
For a complete written transcript of the Dr. Bill Show, go online to www.icarusmusic.com.
And welcome back to the Dr. Bill Show. Let's go to a caller who seems to be having issues communicating with his girlfriend. Caller?
Yeah, I'd had this problem with my girlfriend. She kind of broke up with me. I've been doing everything right. Everything's been going great. We went out. We've gone out for, I don't know, I'd say a good 5-6 months. Everything's good. I mean...
But son, you've got to use communication.
I've done that. I mean, what else can I do? I mean, seriously, I mean, like...
Son. Some girls are just bitches.